Hey everybody, this is Catherine from the Media Education Lab, and you're listening to the Courageous RI podcast, the show that finds common ground, builds media literacy skills, and encourages curiosity for the people of Rhode Island. In this episode, our host Pam Steger talks to Congressman David Cicilline, who served as a U.S. House Representative for Rhode Island's 1st Congressional District since 2011. This year, he'll begin a new role as President and CEO of the Rhode Island Foundation. Today, you'll hear him talk about the role of government in technology regulation, the importance of media literacy for democracy, and how both politicians and community members can attempt to decrease political polarization.
Welcome to the Courageous Rhode Island podcast. Our guest today is Congressman David N. Cicilline, who serves Rhode Island's 1st Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives and leads efforts to implement gun safety legislation on the federal level and pass the first piece of antitrust legislation of the modern era to ensure a fair and competitive online marketplace for startups, consumers, and small businesses. Congressman Cicilline has been leading the fight to hold big tech accountable, overseeing a top-to-bottom investigation into the state of competition in the digital marketplace, and leading the introduction of 6 bipartisan bills to build a stronger online economy and protect consumers and small businesses. His recent book, House on Fire, Fighting for Democracy in the Age of Political Arson, spares no one from criticism as he argues for a politics that produces results and warns about current and future threats to our democracy. Welcome, Congressman Cicilline. It's a pleasure to welcome you, to have you join us today. Since we have such a short time, are we okay with jumping right in?
Yes, I just want to say I'm delighted to be here and thank you for inviting me.
Okay. So you used your chairmanship of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law to publish a sweeping 450-page report detailing the monopolistic practices by the nation's largest tech companies, leading to a suite of bipartisan bills that passed the House, which is almost incredible. Congressman, you've been the leading voice in the House for unearthing and addressing the monopolistic practices by companies like Meta, Google, and Twitter. What progress have you made, and what has proven too hard to tackle without greater resource or political will?
Well, thank you for the question. And the report you referenced was the product of a 16-month investigation that was done in a bipartisan way, co-led by Ken Buck, a Republican, very conservative Republican from Colorado. And what we found in our investigation is that these large technology platforms have monopoly power, and they use their monopoly power to grow their market share, to crush innovation, to harm small businesses and consumers. And so we put together a suite of bills to help restore competition to the digital marketplace. They were all introduced in a bipartisan way, passed out of the Judiciary Committee. Unfortunately, only one of them made it into law. And this was an important one because it was a piece of legislation that will ensure that the antitrust agencies have the resources they need to enforce competition policy. But there's a lot more work to do. And one of the big challenges is, with concentrated economic power comes concentrated political power. Mm-hmm. And so these monopolies spent hundreds of millions of dollars to protect the ecosystem that has generated them profits never seen in the history of the world. And they're going to continue to fight hard against these reforms. The good news is, overwhelmingly, the American people support these reforms. They expect Congress to rein in big tech. So I have no doubt it will ultimately happen.
Thank you. So I believe that that bill that did pass, the measure that raised the fees merging corporations must pay, was included in the end of year omnibus spending bill. That was the first legislative losses ever suffered by the tech industry in decades. And you were widely credited with making the issue a congressional priority. If you could wave a magic wand and enact one change that would most protect consumers' privacy and protect them from misinformation and disinformation, what would that be?
Well, the first thing would be to have a piece of legislation enacted that actually gives consumers or users complete control over their data so that no one could take it, use it, and sell it without your express permission. That's number one. And the second thing I would do is to be sure that these platforms are responsible for the amplification of dangerous, toxic, untrue content. You know, this is a business model that these platforms use that's based on engagement. The more engagement there is, the more money they make on advertising. It turns out the most untruthful, most violent, most dangerous, most provocative content is the stuff that has the most engagement. So they have a business model that incentivizes the amplification of the worst stuff. And so if instead we made them responsible by modifying Section 230, responsible for harms that flowed from their amplification of this terrible content, that would change their conduct. If I could do those two things, we would see a dramatic improvement in our democracy, in a significant reduction in the spread of misinformation, and importantly, some real protections of privacy for users.
I'd love to see that happen. On our side, Courageous Rhode Island has been having conversations that introduces our participants, and we've been thrilled to have over 100 participants every day that we have sessions. But one of them was about that economic system that rewards the likes and the clicks and the stickiness of especially controversial and crazy and fantastic things. So Courageous Rhode Island is using media literacy as a prevention tool against targeted violence and domestic terrorism. A few years back, you let me make a media literacy presentation at a meeting of your Women's Advisory Board. Given your experience in government at many levels, can you talk a bit about why you think media literacy is an important skill for the 21st century? What does it mean for democracy if we are increasingly vulnerable to misinformation and disinformation?
I think it's the single greatest threat to democracy right now. And in many ways, Pam, you are a visionary ahead of your time, because at the time you made that presentation to the Women's Advisory Board, it was really the first time I had seen a presentation on the issue of media literacy. And it now, as you well know, is an urgent and serious challenge to our democracy and to democracies around the world. People receive more information than they've ever received from a variety of online platforms, and people have a responsibility to develop the ability to determine whether something is from a trustworthy, reliable source and whether they can rely on that information. And with the decline of local media and local newspapers, this is particularly challenging. And, you know, if I had a penny for everyone who said, oh, I saw it online, which means exactly nothing other than you saw it online. And it, you know, if you think about what happened on January 6th, there is no doubt that virtually every person who showed up in Washington and participated in that violent insurrection against the government of the United States actually believed that Donald Trump won the election and it was stolen from him by Democrats. I mean, they believe this. Why? Because they consumed this information online. They heard it from the president and others, but they heard all of this from these, you know, dark sources on the web, and they were really radicalized by this misinformation. So it's a very serious problem. We need to really be asking people when they make a statement, where did you learn that? What's the source of that information? Why do you think that's true? Why do you think that's the case? And so I think media literacy ought to be taught in every single school in this country in every grade, because it's never too young to begin to develop those skills.
Thank you. We believe that too. So Courageous Rhode Island is also about addressing the deep polarization that has gripped the U.S. and introducing and modeling practices like bringing people with diverse perspectives together to engage in civil conversations where we practice deep listening and looping for understanding. What are your thoughts about other ways out of our current national polarization, especially at the government level? And what role do individual citizens, what role can they play in bringing about change?
You know, there was a recent veto message issued by the governor of Utah, very, very conservative Republican, and he vetoed a piece of legislation that was targeting trans kids in schools, trans athletes. And he wrote in part that it's a close judgment, and he's not sure he understands an issue carefully, he errs on the side of being kind and being compassionate, being understanding. And I think, you know, that's how we have to approach all these issues. When you run into someone that you have strong disagreements with, I think you begin from a place of kindness and compassion and understanding and ask them, why do you think that's the case? Where did you hear that? Why do you feel that way? And try to respect the individual, even if you strongly disagree. I think an example of that is my work with Ken Buck that I mentioned earlier. Ken Buck and I don't agree on a single issue in the world. Literally, I've tried 25 issues. We found an area that we could work on together in antitrust, and we became great partners and great friends. We don't agree on anything else, and he's very, very conservative. I'm very liberal. But we found an area and said, let's just focus on that. Let's work in a productive way together and avoid these other issues because we're never going to change each other's minds, and we found a way to do that. And I think there are lots of examples of that, and I think, you know, we have much more in common with people, even people we strongly disagree with, than we have different. You know, there's lots of commonalities. And I think just finding those places where you have a shared set of values can find common ground and show people who can work together.
Thank you. It is so important. And it's what we're trying to do with Courageous Rhode Island as well. And at our launch in February, now Secretary of State Greg Amore talked about how he did the same kind of thing with Republican Representative Brian Newberry and Democratic Senator Hannah Gallo to craft the civics education bill that they worked on for years before it finally passed last year, that will require some form of civics education for all Rhode Island school children. So we're looking forward to that as well. And we've been working closely with the Rhode Island Civic Learning Coalition to try and get media literacy in as part of that as well.
Right.
So as of June 1st, you're going to be a private citizen for the first time in how many years? I mean,
before 28, almost 30 years. Half my life I've been in elective office.
Wow, that's amazing. And I'd like to say thank you, since you were my mayor, my local representative, and my congressman, for excellent service over the years. So what are you most excited about in taking on your new role as CEO of the Rhode Island Foundation?
You know, what I'm very excited about is, as I look at the work of the Rhode Island Foundation, it has, you know, focused in three areas, principally education, healthcare, and economic development. So three issues that I've worked on for almost 30 years. But having the opportunity to lead this organization, which is making such a difference in the lives of Rhode Islanders, and to be able to see the impact of that investment up close, almost like you're back to your mayor days, and to be back home in a state that I love, serving the whole state, is incredibly exciting to me. And I also, you know, hope that there's going to be an opportunity to really think about some of, build upon some of the work that you do, Pam. And that is, I think if you look at the divisions in our country and the strategies to sort of bring people together and really heal the nation, the community foundations are in a uniquely qualified position to be part of this work in a way, frankly, that maybe an elected official isn't. And so I hope that we can create an example for the country of what community foundations can do to help bring communities together, to develop mutual respect and to strengthen our democracy and to do all the things that are necessary in a free and open society. And I think there's a lot of exciting work being done in this space, and a community foundation, I think, is uniquely positioned to be a big part of that.
I agree. And I actually have been heartened since doing more research into the bipolarization for Courageous Rhode Island. And recently I just saw something that said there are 7,000 kind of groups around the nation that are now trying to do something to bridge the divide. And that's what I've been finding. I'm finding so many allies and so many people who are excited that something is happening here in Rhode Island. And actually, because the Media Ed Lab, which received the funding through URI and through the Department for Homeland Security, their reach, our reach at the Media Ed Lab is national and global. So we've been getting people from all over the country and all over the world coming to our Courageous Conversations as well, that we're very excited about. So could you just wrap up by telling us both what motivated you for in your interest in taking on the CEO position at the Rhode Island Foundation, and also maybe what you're going to miss most about being in public service, and especially about being in Congress?
Yeah, absolutely. So what motivated me was the opportunity to lead an organization that I know has really an oversized impact in our state. You know, there's no important public policy that the Rhode Island Foundation is not at the table and part of. So the ability and the opportunity to really shape public policy that will impact the state that I love and that will help really promote the well-being of Rhode Islanders in a very direct way. So for me, that was very exciting. Also, the opportunity to move home, which is great after, you know, traveling a lot. What I'm going to miss most about being in Congress is the incredible colleagues that I'm leaving behind. I have just developed these extraordinary friendships, you know, particularly during some of the most difficult years in Congress. You know, you develop real bonds with people who share your values as you're fighting to protect democracy and reduce gun violence and rein in big tech. And so I'm going to miss the day-to-day contact with a group of really extraordinary people. I'm going to stay in close touch with them, but for sure, that's the part that I'm going to miss the most.
Well, we are going to be happy to have you back full time in Rhode Island. And I want to tell our listeners and our viewers to definitely buy this book, House on Fire.
Thank you for that promotion.
Fighting for Democracy in the Age of Political Arson, which is hopefully what we're all about and what we're all trying to do right now. So, Congressman, thank you so much for giving up your valuable time to be with us today. We appreciate it, and we're looking forward to welcoming you back full-time to Rhode Island.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.